Sufferings, it's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. It was brought to you by our good friends at River, the best place to buy Bitcoin. River makes it very easy to buy Bitcoin, to sell Bitcoin. If you want to do that, you shouldn't sell it. They actually have a new thing at checkout if you're trying to sell Bitcoin. Michael Saylor comes out and says, are you sure you want to sell Bitcoin right now? Probably shouldn't. You should DCA into Bitcoin. River makes it very easy. You can set it and forget it by daily, weekly, monthly. If you DCA using River, you're not going to pay any fees on those buys. It's the easiest way to gift Bitcoin with River Link. You set an amount of Bitcoin you want to gift somebody. You create a link. You send that to somebody. You text it to them. You email it to them. You DM it to them. They click the link, and then they can sweep the Bitcoin to their River account or a wallet of their choice. It's a beautiful thing. River builds all their infrastructure in-house. They don't depend on third parties. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. It's where we buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC. Sign up today. You'll get $5 worth of Bitcoin. This rip was also brought to you by good friends down the hall, Unchained. Unchained is here to help you eliminate single points of failure in your custody model. Price of Bitcoin's going up. If you talked about owning Bitcoin publicly, you could be subjected to SIM swap attacks. Had a friend had this happen to him recently where he got SIM swapped attack. They went to go drain his exchanges, got past 2FA, all of that. Luckily, they didn't get his Bitcoin because he has his Bitcoin in an Unchained multisig vault, which keeps your keys offline, and they're always in cold storage. So you don't have to worry about somebody SIM swapping you and stealing your Bitcoin. Unchained also has an IRA product. If you have a retirement account and you want to get exposure to Bitcoin, get direct exposure. You don't have to buy the ETFs. You can actually hold the Bitcoin, take it in kind, as one should be able to do. Unchained makes that very easy. Go hit up Unchained's concierge team. Go to unchained.com/consultation. Learn about all their products, the vault, the IRA. They have a trading desk. They have a lending desk. They're doing it the right way. Unchained.com/consultation. Tell them that TFTC sent you. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're an individual out there who wants to accept Bitcoin as payment, Zaprite is the best way to do that. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC, set up an account, and Zaprite makes it very easy to connect your own wallets. They're wallet agnostic. You simply enter an XPub, connect your LND node, connect your Strike account, whatever it may be, and Zaprite handles the invoicing side of things. You can send invoices, payment links. They have a WooCommerce integration. So if you're a trucker, a rancher, a farmer, a doctor, a lawyer wants to accept Bitcoin as payment, go to Zaprite, connect your wallets, and start doing so today. The best part about Zaprite is they also accept fiat payments, so you don't have to have individual invoicing for people that pay in Bitcoin and people that pay in fiat. You do it all in one spot. You can connect Stripe, your ACH, and you send one invoice, and they can pay in fiat or Bitcoin. It's beautifully designed. They have they have dashboards, analytics, everything you need to hand over to your bookkeeper or your accountant. So again, go to zaprite.com/TFTC. Use the promo code TFTC at sign out, and you're going to get $40 off their annual subscription fee, which is typically $240. So with the code TFTC, you drop that down to $200. Zaprite.com/TFTC. Last but not least, this rip was brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co. Bull market's here. You may be looking to hire as your runway is extended because you have a bunch of Bitcoin on your corporate treasury. Go to Bitcoin Talent Co. It's a recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. They understand Bitcoin multisig. They understand mining. They understand the Lightning Network, and they're highly competent recruiters. Andy, the co-founder, started Uber, grew their team from 100 to 10,000. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to go find the best talent in tech, design, banking, finance, whatever you need. They're going to understand your needs, and they're going to go get you the best talent to help us build out the Bitcoin standard. BitcoinTalent.co. Tell them the TFTC sent you and enjoy this rip.
Okay.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
from Bay Ridge, Brooklyn to Patagonia, Arizona. It's quite the drastic change.
Yeah. After decades of chasing crime and reporting news and being in the heart of the beast, so to say, I wanted the opposite. I grew up in rural life, and I wanted to return to it to raise my kids.
Yeah. What was it like working for the New York Daily News?
It was intense, nonstop intensity. My job specifically was the national reporter. So anytime anything major broke across the country, I'd have a bag packed, hit the next flight, get going. And the adrenaline you feel is absolutely hard to describe because it's nonstop and you're experiencing the most intense moments of people's life on a continual basis. But there's a time span on that because you can't keep, you can only do it for so long until you start almost feeling numb to it in a weird way. And if you're not sincere in what you're doing, it's hard to be excellent.
Yeah. And so what were some of the more intense beats that you, or stories that you covered particularly?
I covered every mass shooting from 2005 to 2014. And I dealt with a lot of grief. I wrote a book on Newtown for Simon and Schuster on the Sandy Hook tragedy. I'm still in touch with some of the parents.
Yeah.
It was very intense. You know, when you go to a child's funeral, it leaves an imprint on you. And a lot of my formative journalism years in New York City were spent trying to understand the motive of mass shootings, which would often come down to mental illness. And one of the frustrations was the way the media landscape worked was narratives would be kind of crafted from both the political left and the political right. And they wanted, so I'd go on Fox News or MSNBC or CNN or Good Morning America, and either like you have 2.5 minutes to 3 minutes to deliver like a spot. And you'd find how the host would always try to guide you to talk about guns, and nobody really wanted to discuss mental illness, which was the defining characteristic of all of these shooters. They weren't just a little bit sick. They were extremely mentally ill, with the exception of Fort Hood's Major Nadal Hassan, who was not mentally ill. He had a viewpoint on the war that was happening in the Middle East. That's why he conducted a shooting. But the rest of them were, I mean, they weren't just like eccentric people. They were very, very, very sick.
And that, as I listened to the No Agenda podcast with Adam Curry and John Dvorak, and I've been listening to that for probably 5 years, and they'll bring up mass shootings from time to time. And the one thing, it's not only the mental illness, how much do you think like the SSRIs play into it as well?
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah, definitely. A lot of these people, even though they're deceased and this should be public information, it's not known how many and what kind of medication. So in the case of Adam Lanza, he was on medications, and the link between that is not, you know, you won't find a lot of science on it because it's not funded. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And that's part of the narrative and how it's crafted. There isn't this public outcry for real answers in that realm, which would provide the only tangible way to prevent the next shooting. Because these gun laws don't, these gun restrictions don't prevent any, they not, I always talk to advocates on this issue because I still get a lot of emails and requests to speak about mass shootings in Newtown, but you can't, none of the laws that are being proposed would have changed the last 12 mass shootings. Mm-hmm. They just wouldn't have.
No. That's, I don't want to say I feel passionate about it, but every time it comes up, it does perplex me. I'm like, we should be focusing on the SSRI side of this because you watch the commercials for these pharmaceuticals and it's like side effects are, could cause depression, suicidal thoughts.
But if you say it fast enough at the end of the commercial, while there's like a fuzzy dog jumping on a ball on a trampoline, you don't really notice.
No.
It's like, you know, usage of this might cause you to kill your family and yourself, but, and we move on.
Well, I mean, it's not the segue I thought we would jump into the book with, but it is a good one because why are people taking the SSRIs? Why are people depressed? Diet, food has a lot to go into that.
And one of the ways that experience uncovering crime and finding motive and dealing with these mass shootings prepared me for this work was because they're like the mass shootings, there's a very severe narrative being pushed on food and nutrition. And I think it provided me the insight and the tools to be able to really see through the narrative and find the effective routes to access the information needed to really cast what is true as best to my ability. And I feel like Fiat Food accomplished that.
Yeah. And we were talking out, outside the studio, the motivation, the inspiration for Fiat Food, the Fiat Standard, Chapter 8. What about that chapter particularly stuck out to you?
During COVID, I was always very, I've interviewed presidents and senators and congressmen and governors, and I've always been skeptical of power centers. And during COVID, it really jumped the shark because I understood that politicians lied. They do all the time, but there's generally to their best interest, I'd assumed, rationally, most of the time. But COVID, it was kind of like, they weren't even really pretending to have our best interests at heart. The masks were off. And it led me down a rabbit hole where I began questioning, you know, a lot of, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I grew up believing in a lot of our American institutions. COVID changed me in that way, where it was clear that our leaders and authorities and government, they did not have our best interests of the American people at heart. And it sent me down into currency. Shockingly, I kind of nerd out over money sometimes and economics. I have a peripheral interest in it, and it led me to Bitcoin Standard by Saifedean Ammous, which I enjoyed. But it was the Fiat Standard that I really took to, and in particular, Chapter 8. A chapter he wrote called Fiat Food, and it's a very short chapter, and in it he makes what appear to be just these ridiculous arguments that our food system in America has been hijacked by corporate enterprises looking to profit, a weird religious group hoping to avert the end of days, and a government hoping to obscure the cost of monetary inflation. And all these things he claimed come together to ruin our food supply. So I read this chapter and I respect the shit out of Saifedean, like as an economist, but I'm like, he's not a reporter. What is this? He's not a nutritionist. I was like, what the hell is going on in this chapter? So I kind of put my reporter hat on and I began fact checking almost neurotically this chapter. And what I discovered blew my mind, because not only had Saif been correct, but I would argue, and I do in my book, he understated it severely. And I immediately couldn't stop thinking about it. I became obsessed and I contacted Saif personally and I said, look, here's who I am. Here's what I do. This deserves a book. I'm the person who should write it. I'm somebody who's published with major publishing houses. I've published with Simon & Schuster, HarperCollins, Scholastic. However, no publishing house is going to take this. It won't. You publish a book conventionally, it goes through lawyers and, you know, it goes through 20 different editors, and they're not going to let this see the day of light. Like, I want to do this. We don't even shouldn't approve. I literally said, you should start your own publishing house. And he told me that he had been thinking about that already. So it was a real synergy. He was thinking of launching his own publishing house, and I became his first author, which was a real honor. And, a year later, countless hours of FOIA requests and out comes Fiat Food.
Yeah. what was the thing that stuck out to you in Chapter 8 the most, where you're like, ah, oh, this has to be bullshit?
I think it was how nutrition science had been corrupted to the extent that it had, where essentially we're living in a 50-year PSYOP, whereas...
With Ansel Keys at the middle of it.
With Ansel Keys at the middle of it. And I try to write this narratively because as a crime reporter, I like things to go sequentially and in order. And what I discovered was it is true. So you have this extremely bizarre, kind of obscure in the beginning of the 19th century religious movement called the Seventh-day Adventists, who came from the Miller movement. And it was started by a woman named Ellen G. White, who's walking home from school one day and gets hit in the head with a rock. She wakes up from a small coma, blood everywhere. But to her surprise, God is now speaking to her. And God says, Ellen, the end of days are coming. You need to warn people. You're my messenger. And the way to purify bodies, the way to avert the end of days, is to thwart the carnal desires of young men and women. You need to suppress that, because that these carnal desires, sex drive, leads to not only every health malady you could think of, but it warps your soul. So she and the church became messengers that meat, especially red meat, which they believed, correctly by the way, brought on these carnal desires. They believe that by changing the meat, by making people, having people eat grains instead of meat, that it'll purify body and soul. And to do this, they needed to change the American diet. And at the time, Americans ate nothing. Like, they ate meat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, if they could afford it. If they couldn't, that was when they would eat grains or other food. Ellen hired somebody named, a protege of hers, John Harvey Kellogg, who she met as a young man. He grew up in the church. He was a vegetarian. And she tasked him with coming up with a food that would substitute eggs and bacon and steak for breakfast. And that's how he came up with Kellogg's Corn Flakes. And just to give you a bit of insight on the kind of man John Harvey Kellogg was, he was a real sociopath. It's kind of hard to overstate his influence at the time. He was a celebrity doctor of the day. So he gave speeches and writing, a very charismatic character, would walk around and dressed from head to toe in a white suit with a cockatoo on his shoulder. He'd break out into spontaneous song. But as advice to parents who feared that their children were masturbating, he suggested, in the case of women, pouring carbolic acid on their clitorises. Having surgery on young boys without anesthesia so that they muscle memory would associate cages. This is the kind of man he was. After he left the church years later, because he discovered Ellen White, like almost all vegans, Ellen was eating meat. She got caught eating fried chicken. The chef at the place where they all worked was very concerned about this, and I was able to access letters from him that played this out, but John Harvey Kellogg stayed in character. After he left the church, he became a eugenicist in Michigan, and through his wealth was able to push for to remove the reproductive organs and sterilize over 3,100 women who he found undesirable, who were mental deviants, whatever that meant for the time. And so I'm talking about the church. I'm talking about the Seventh Adventist Day Church, and people might be like, Well, what does that have to do with nutrition? Seventh-day Adventist Church, John Harvey Kellogg had a protege named Leanna Cooper, who started the American Dietetic Association. That became firmly entrenched in government as nutrition policy. This is all pre-1970, so this is all a growing movement. And it still, come 1970, Americans are still primarily eating meat. But what happened on, as I'm sure most of your audience knows, on August 15th, 1971, Richard Nixon decoupled from gold. So up until that point, American citizens couldn't redeem their promissory notes. I feel weird calling it a promissory note because the promise is broken. But foreign banks still could. So it provided a powerful restraint on printing of dollars. Nixon was confronted with something horrible. Wasn't entirely his fault, but there were far more promissory notes that were issued than we had gold in our reserves. So we had perpetuated a fraud, and all it would have taken was a few countries at the same time trying to redeem their promissory notes for us to be exposed as the liars we were, much like the Bank of England in 1914, done the same thing, which led to the creation of fiat, which Saifedean really examines closely in the fiat standard. But on August 15th, 1971, when he did that, the American government had kind of a choice to make, and it would be to just tell the American people, look, we're going to print a shitload of currency. We're going to flood the market with dollars. And as a result, things that you buy are going to go up. And they chose a different route, which was to try to hide the inflationary theft of their citizenry through changing the food supply. And why the food supply? Give you an example. Nixon had a Department of Agriculture secretary named Earl Butz, a real piece of shit. And he would talk about how housewives, they buy a sofa maybe once every 10 years. Mm-hmm. So they don't really notice the price rise. But food prices rising is something that governments have long known leads to political instability. And I outline this quite extensively in my book. When food prices go very high, people riot. People tolerate endless wars. People tolerate government corruption. But when the price of food goes up, it's not good for the retainment of political power. I'll point to 12,500 food and energy related riots in Europe in 2005 to 2007. And then even more recently in 2022, this wasn't quite covered accurately, but the riots and protests in Sri Lanka were the result of the rising price of food, especially red meat, eggs, and milk. And that led to hundreds of thousands of people storming the palace and the Sri Lankan government having to flee. So governments are very sensitive to the cost of rising food. But what they decided to do rather stealthily, and I would argue successfully, was through a series of subsidies to the corn, soy, sugar industries, and tilting the fiat table towards bullshit nutrition studies, they were able to psyop the American public into believing that the food that they had been eating for thousands of years, basically animal-based products, dairy, people ate fruit if they found it in season, if a bear hadn't got into it, or maybe a little honey, but people were eating tons of leaf green vegetables and things. They were eating meat if they could find it. But to psyop the American people to believe that the diet they've been eating for thousands of years, in which they've evolved, has actually been bad for them, and that a much cheaper food supply was in their best interest. And what you see happening at this point, which I outline in my book, is all this funding start going towards these different groups. So now the church, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which is sort of still looked at in the public as more of a curiosity, even though they're a growing movement, they're getting millions and millions of dollars of fiat currency pushed their way through, in particular, a university called Loma Linda University in California, where I'm guessing a lot of your audience is exposed to a lot of studies that come out of Loma Linda University, which say meat is bad. So come up with an ailment, cancer, hemorrhoids, blurry vision, meat causes X. Hundreds of these studies, almost all of them exclusively come from Loma Linda University, which is run by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which doesn't conduct they're not real studies. They're observational studies. So observational studies are equivalent of handing out flyers, really. It's like, I could say, I took a study and 94% of people who have cancer have at one point drank in milk. Headline, cancer linked to milk consumption. Observational study. A real scientist will explain, and I've spoken to so many for this book, that you want random controlled studies where variables can be controlled, because then you can actually present causal relationships, where observational studies can only give you association. it's not science. It's very easily manipulated. So you can take basically any subject and make it. I mean, I saw one recently from Loveland University that was meat causes diabetes. But forget that, you know, glucose and meat, it's nonsensical. But they're not. What I also learned is like they're not trying to impress other scientists. They're trying to make headlines for people because most people are working and they don't have time to go through the actual study, right? So they see the headline, right? This is insane. And the other player was industry, which profits far more from selling you Doritos, which they can print at scale, almost like fiat paper, than they can raising meats, which is time intensive. Government soaks it all in because at the end of it all, their mission is to stay in power and retain power. And if they can convince you that food is actually affordable, then their chances at retaining power have increased. In reality, the food is still cheap. But the nutrients required for species-specific humans has increased considerably. I outline this. So like red meat is becoming increasingly a food of the upper classes. Mm-hmm. And whereas in the past, obesity was associated with affluence and abundance, now it's a sign of poverty, not of wealth necessarily, but of the body's nutrients. And it didn't take a giant conspiracy for all this to happen. So there was no evidence that there was ever like a smoky room where these groups got together. It just was in everybody's best interest. And when fiat came along, it tilted the tables to such an extent because what you have in fiat is really the most, I would argue, the most powerful tool in human history, because in the fiat money printer, you have a weapon that you can weaponize the entire productive labor of not just America, but since the Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944, where a lot of the free world agreed to base their currency on the dollar, we're weaponizing the entire world's productive labor. And when you aim it at something, it's hard to look away.
Yeah. And so when it comes to fiat food, again, going back to the idea that there's no smoky room with people making decisions. You essentially had Nixon ripping us off the gold standard, which presented a problem, which was if women who are shopping week in, week out at the grocery stores see that food prices are going up, there's going to be political unrest. And so we need to utilize this religious group effectively in their studies to convince people to eat cheaper food so we don't have that problem.
That was definitely one of the elements. I mean, in the early 1900s, there was no government food policy. Mm-hmm. You know why? Because people didn't need me on a podcast. They didn't need Sean Baker. They knew what to eat. Like a lion knew what to eat and a wolf knew what to eat and a chinchilla knew what to eat. But there's been a lot of confusion that was intentional. Mm-hmm. They did that with intent. They caused it because they muddied the waters. And another example would be what I would consider a intellectual prostitute by the name of Frederick Stare, who started the Harvard Nutrition Foundation. So under the name, the prestigious name of Harvard, this bastard went about telling people that sugar was good for them. A Coke every day was a healthy in-between meal snack, he would say. He was funded completely by industry. In his own book, he talked about getting $1 million to start a magazine from Kellogg's, and these cereal companies funded him exclusively. He would talk about how red dye was really good for you. And this came under the name of Harvard. So when you'd push, there was a man who tried to warn under Nixon. Later, he went into private life and he went to Congress and he tried to warn people about these cereals. Like, these cereals are packed of sugar and they're changing the children's taste buds. Now kids are demanding everything be sweet, and they put Stare on to rebuke him. And Stare came out and was like, no. Sugar cereals are so much healthier than bacon and eggs. And things have not changed. You look at the Tufts Food Compass. Okay, that's the leading, are you aware of?
No.
Okay, so that's the leading indicator of health right now. And these, you have nutritionists who spent years from Tufts University with all these great degrees, Dinush Musafarin is the head of the scientists studying these. And they concluded, after years of rigorous study, that Fruit Loops are much healthier for you than eggs and red meat. Almond, chocolate almond milk is better for you than whole milk. And I think it's Cinnamon Toast cereal bars are healthier for you than red meat. And all. It's amazing. But when you go onto their website and you pull up their papers, you see who their partners are. Their partners are PepsiCo, Danone, all these corporate interests. They're paymasters. And you see the synergy of how these groups come together in January of 2023 when you have Dr. Fatima Stanford from appear on 60 Minutes and talk about obesity being not from lifestyle, but a genetic brain disorder. People were not responsible. And then referring people who have obesity not to change their lifestyle, but to take Ozempic.
Ozempic, yeah.
By the way, that same episode was funded by Ozempic. It's the main sponsor. And then you see the Tufts Food Pyramid come out that same month saying that processed cereal grains are healthier for you than eggs. Fruit Loops are healthier for you than eggs and bacon and meat. And a few months later, the American Pediatric Association for the first time changed their guidelines on obesity to say that children as young as 11 should be getting Ozempic. So I can sit back and think, I didn't find in my research any connection between all of them outwardly, but I think I'd be naive to think that this wasn't planned, right? Like that there wasn't some kind of rollout. This was a marketing campaign. And I think that's what your audience needs to understand is that when they're looking at food science now, and I put science in quotes, they need to look at it as a PR campaign because that's exactly what it is.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. Back to the show.
That's where legacy media comes into play, because due to the digitization of our world and a lot of discourse moving online and a lot of independent journalists popping up, like the funding for incumbent media has basically become like, we need a partner with somebody in the pharma industry, somebody in the food industry to pay for ads. And a lot of these reports, like the 60 Minutes interviews, they're essentially just paid spots, native advertising.
You're spot on. And that's why, you know, my first books I would go on CNN and Fox News and Good Morning America and to Today Show, and I talk about my books. You think any of them would have me on today talking about this book?
No.
I know these people too. Like some of them are friends of mine, these producers. What you're doing, what Joe Rogan and Safe and Sean Baker, I mean, that's the new media. This is it. And that's why you're growing.
Yeah.
And I think it's beautiful. It's just a decentralization of thought.
Well, we need to get the messages that it's beautiful and it's important. And I do think it's very prominent, but for some reason or the other, the incumbent media still has this prestige, and most people take what they're saying like, oh, it's the truth.
Do they? I don't know. Maybe you talk in different circles than me.
The NPCs, the normies, if you will. Like Ozempic's a big thing right now. Like I have to tell some family members, like, oh, I'm just going to go to Ozempic. I'm like, please do not do this.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
This is a dangerous drug.
And in 2 years, they'll pull it. But yeah. In the meantime, they would have made $18 billion. And, you know, they'll have a new drug that will take 2 years for them to pull that. Mm-hmm. And the cycle will continue. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I guess it goes more into the civil war that we're in right now. And I think that we'll look back at this time period in the future and think, wow, it's a civil war of ideologies. Yeah. And one of the blessings I think that happened during the period of COVID is a lot of the people I was friends with who had faith in authority, had faith in credentials, are thinking about things very differently now from the left and from the right. You see it in the rise of somebody like RFK Jr., mm-hmm. whose ideas just a few years ago would have been considered very out of the mainstream, but he's gaining momentum. And I think it's beautiful in the sense that health, our physical health, presupposes our ability to really be an active, independent human. And it's all really connected in that way. And if they can get us dependent, whether it be on grains and food, and then we're metabolically compromised mm-hmm. because we're addicted to sugar and we're unwell, then we're really kind of fodder for anything they're going to throw at us. But you see this through the Department of Agriculture's war, for instance, on raw milk. I do a lot of stories on a man named Amos Miller who lives, he's an Amish guy in Pennsylvania, and they're assaulting him. They did armed government raids. Just today I did a story, or I worked on a story earlier this morning on two gentlemen who they're in jail. They've been in jail for almost 10 days now because they're providing, I feel silly saying this out loud, they're providing illegal ultrasounds to cows of dairy farmers. Yeah, they're in jail, and they went in early morning hours to a family's house, and they accidentally went into the kids' room first. They scared the shit out of these children. Their dad's in jail. So there's a real war being waged, and I bring that up because it's connected, because the USDA is captured by industry right now. So why are they against raw milk producers? It's not because they want us to be unhealthy. It's because that's just a consequence, because they really view the American people as a means to an end. It's because their donors, the people who pay the USDA, and it's not a conspiracy, just look it up. I outline it in my book. It's on their own website. Their partners are the big food corporations. So they want to weed out the small guy.
Well, it's similar to the Federal Reserve, where you hear the Federal Reserve, you're like, oh, that's part of the government. It's not. And then similar with USDA, which is part of the government, but it's funded by private interests.
Exactly, mainly. Yeah. Cartel bankers run, you know, it's like a cartel of bankers. They make these decisions. And but there's pushback happening now, which I'm very appreciative of. And you can see it. My eyes are opening in ways I didn't know. I mean, I've been carnivore. I'm not always as carnivore as I should be, but about 2 years now, and I've never felt better.
You look great.
Oh, thanks, man.
Amos Miller is something, because I'm from Philadelphia, and obviously have a good understanding of Lancaster County. Big fan of Reading Terminal in Philadelphia, where the Amish would come in and bring their baked goods and the other stuff that they were growing out and cooking out in Lancaster. And we actually had Chris Hume on from the Lancaster
page, okay, cool. I know Chris. Like, I've touched base with him a few times
right after the raid. And I think Amos's story is particularly interesting for two reasons. Number one, he's run his business for many years and had a lot of success, and people love his food, and it's a consensual contract between him and his customers that's been going on for some time. I mean, they're clinging to that one Listeria case, that woman in Florida who had, again, I think it's an observational, like, association thing, where she had drank the raw milk, which raw milk in and of itself is another psyop. It's just milk. And it was until...
It's milk that hasn't been cooked, so it's healthy.
And we drank it that way for millennia, up until about a century ago.
I still drink about a half gallon every day.
Yeah. That's what the beauty of living in Austin is. We have... very easy access to raw milk. My boys love it. That's my protein shake. I do raw milk, a few raw eggs, some raw honey, and that's what I drink.
Unpublicized are all the cases of people get sick from cooked milk.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, the reason the corporations don't want raw milk, I had it explained to me, was just how you could treat your cow like complete shit. The cow can eat its own shit. None of it matters. You cook the milk. And a raw milk farmer, and I recommend your audience get to know one, get to know the farmer, get to know the cows, they have to take really nice care of their cow, or else the milk doesn't meet the standards. No. So I feel really blessed that in Arizona I have a raw milk farmer who I meet up once a week at a farmer's market. We make the transaction, but it's all connected. And in the currency, And the reason this is a safe published this, and this is why it's important to Saifedean as well, and it's under his publishing house, is because the reason Bitcoin ties into this is because it doesn't have to be Bitcoin. Any hard currency, if it was adopted, I just happen to think Bitcoin's by far the most effective one from what I can understand of it, is that when you end the Fed, is you have to understand that the Fed, which I know you do, is the reason that these distortions need to be created. Mm-hmm. So every time you buy a little Bitcoin with your fiat, you're taking a knife into the Fed and doing a little jab. And if you end the Fed, you end the reason for the distortions. And then there are no more distortions. Like, there's no incentive to manipulate the money supply to hide inflation when there's no monetary inflation.
Yeah.
And people, including the lower economic stratums, will be able then to afford the nutrients essential for life. And the consequences and ripple effects of that are impossible to overstate.
Yeah, I mean, what you were mentioning earlier about beef becoming a high-class good.
Yeah.
Because of all these distortions in the market. I mean, that's with fiat food. Like, we have these distortions in the market because the government and the central banks are able to print money or issue debt and then give it to corn farmers to subsidize the production of high fructose corn syrup, which then lowers the cost of these goods, which are worse for you nutritionally. And then that's in the pricing signal to the market, like, hey, we should be growing and distributing this food versus ranching beef. And so now, because of that price distortion, the incentive to actually bring quality beef to market has been perturbed and it's been made harder to do so. And now we have a situation where the head of cattle that we have in the U.S. is at the lowest it's been since the 1970s, I think.
Yeah, and your audience should understand that this war is only beginning on food, and it's only going to increase. It's only in the beginning stages. So one of the interesting things that I learned was the Seventh-day Adventist churches teamed up, it's a bad term to use. They haven't formally teamed up. They've embraced and kind of colluded with the environmental movement. So throughout the last 100 years, the tool that they use to try to get people away from meat has always been their own guilt. That's what I've noticed. It's, don't eat meat. It started out, don't eat meat because, your body and your soul are going to be bad. And then it changed and it kind of evolved to, in the 70s, there was a book called The Population Bomb by probably like the worst forecaster, like the reverse Nostradamus, a guy named Paul Ehrlich. You're familiar with him, yeah?
Yes.
Everything he said was dumb and demonstrably false, but you'll find him still being referenced today. It's absolutely amazing. But he released this book, and in the 70s, it kind of, the argument evolved from spiritual to more meat is a lot of resources. So save the earth, because there's too many people and they're going to eat all the food up. So don't eat meat. And now it's evolved to meat being so now obviously we're losing people because John Harvey Kellogg's ability to get us to eat meat did in fact lower fertility rates. I mean, to get us to eat all these grains, our fertility rates are going down. People are not having as many kids. But now it's evolved to like your consumption of meat is now a temperature gauge on the earth. And in New York City, just last year, Mayor Adams had a press conference. Mayor Eric Adams also claimed he was a vegan, also got exposed for eating meat.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
I knew he was vegan. I didn't know he got caught.
He's not a vegan. These people, it's vegan publicly, but he got busted. He's admitted it. He's like, I have to eat meat. He's a human. Like, of course, And then it's funny because, they all beat themselves up over it, all this guilt they feel. But now, eating meat's a temperature gauge on the earth, and temperature, it's global warming's kind of adopted it. And, humans have always done this thing where we've like blamed our behavior for the weather. You know, in the 1600s, we would burn eccentric women when we didn't get enough precipitation for the crops, and there was human sacrifice before that. we still do this. It's just a little more sophisticated. And in the sense of New York, we sacrifice our children with meatless Mondays for schools. And there's meatless Fridays, I think, but they're going to expand it. And they're taking it out really on the school children. But I guess I wanted to say that, so your audience is prepared. In the recent omnibus bill passed by Congress, there was $105 million delegated towards something called electronic cattle livestock tracking. Mm-hmm. I spoke to Congressman Thomas Massey about this, who owns dairy cows, and he was explaining to me that this is going to be used to monitor the livestock to, in the end, be weaponized to control meat consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And that's terrifying.
Well, it's multifaceted. It's not only that, it's also a way to impose cost on smaller ranchers that they cannot afford. And so just to push them out of the market, where it's, if you don't comply and tag your cattle with this electronic tracker, you can't ranch anymore. You can't bring your product to market. And so they're going to,
yeah, exactly.
Well,
it's always to the benefit of them. But yeah, I mean, and it's only beginning. I mean, they haven't even implemented it yet, but you see this in places in Europe, like in Ireland, where they've used methods like this already, where they say it's not going to be implemented for this reason, but it has been. In the name of climate.
Yeah.
But just remember, if you're eating nothing but cereal and Doritos, you don't notice inflation rising. In that realm, you're happy with your government. You think, oh my gosh, I mean, I could go buy a giant box of cereal that feeds me all day for $3.95. Go to buy a ribeye. It's very different. And one of the things I have to deal with when I talk to people about my diet is they're like, I would love to just do what you're doing, but it's so expensive. And, you can get ground beef still. There still are ways to get it, but it's difficult. It's hard.
Yeah, it is. No, I feel it.
Yeah.
Like, we try to eat as much beef and eggs as possible and do it in a way where we're getting it from local ranchers and not the grocery store as much. I mean, obviously, we're not perfect. We buy steaks from Whole Foods, HEB, quite often, but we're lucky with local pastures here. That's what we try to get most of our beef and eggs and milk. And
nice.
It is not.
You get raw milk? You get,
yes.
Raw, oh, yeah. Sweet. Isn't it great?
It is.
So amazing.
It's so much sweeter.
And yeah, but the corporations don't like it. It takes a lot of work for the cows, and you know, it's very, yeah, difficult for them to deal with this. They want to cook your milk and burn everything and then give you the bloody pus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. Once you have, because I fell for the side of raw milk. I was like, oh, we can't drink raw milk. I'm going to get listeria.
That's crazy. I'm going to, yeah, die.
And then in the last few years, we've been buying it. Like, the first sip of raw milk compared to the hyper-pasteurized stuff that I drank growing up, it's like, holy shit, this is completely different.
I had to take raw milk in. I play a lot of basketball weekly. I have a tournament at my house. I have a little court, and a lot of high school kids come, and there's one kid named Jose. Shout out to Jose. He's just very big, and he pushes my ass around everywhere. And during carnivore, I lost too much weight. I introduced the raw milk, and I was able to put more weight on. So I drink the raw milk. It also relieves my sugar cravings.
Yeah.
No, it's like, because I don't want to be in ketosis for years of my life, right? I don't think that's really healthy. I'm not sure. I guess I defer to the health experts on that. But the raw milk's been very helpful to just maintain what I consider a healthy weight, yeah, for myself.
Yeah. That's one thing. Yeah. Again, going back to like the protein shakes, I don't want to like buy the powdered crap from GMC or whatever.
Yeah.
It's filled with a bunch of shit. I'd rather do raw eggs, raw milk.
One thing I didn't mention, on the corporate side, that I just would like to share with your audience, is that it isn't just that they have an interest in the profit margin on like Doritos is far higher than it is on you know, meat, but they also manipulated these studies. So a lot of the reasons that we believe that saturated fat found in red meat causes a rise in cholesterol, which then causes heart problems, comes from corporate funded studies by the sugar industry towards Ansel Keys. Ansel Keys didn't need the sugar industry to do this. He was a very motivated man. He was a scientist in the 50s and the 60s. But he wasn't a nutritionist, and he wasn't a heart doctor. And you know, he had this theory that saturated fat found in meat caused a rise in cholesterol, which caused heart attacks. And in the 50s, everybody was really worried about heart attacks after, especially Eisenhower had a heart attack in 51. Mm-hmm. out 10 days, people were very scared because it's kind of like a nightmare, the silent killer, they call it, right? Everybody was racing to find an answer. And at the time, people smoked. There's like competing theories, smoke and all these different high stress types was another theory. And so Key's theory was never proven. And people, other scientists like John Yudkin from Great Britain proposed sugar. There was a higher correlation to sugar, but these were all, as we were saying, observational studies. But Ansel Keys was like, you know what? In 1968, we're going to do something. We're going to do a randomized control study called the Minnesota Coronary Survey, 1968 to 1973, happening in about a dozen nursing homes and mental institutions in Minnesota, where all the variables could be controlled. So they could really establish a causal relationship. So they do the study. 1968 comes, 1973 comes, the study's over. Nobody talks about the study. It doesn't come out. Years pass. Nobody knows what happened to this multi-million dollar government-funded study. So finally, hat tip to the New York Times. Occasionally, they do a good story. Very rare, but it happens. I've worked for them in the past, so I can say this. They were like, what happened to that study? This is in 2016, decades later. Somebody from their department was like, what happened to that study? They were able to find, Ansel Keys was already dead. Another researcher, a guy named Ivan, they found his son. They're like, what happened to this study? And the son looked in the basement of the house and found boxes of the Minnesota, labeled Minnesota Coronary Survey. Opens it up. To their shock, the study results showed that higher cholesterol rates were associated with better health outcomes. Lower cholesterol rates were associated with worse health outcomes in terms of mortality. And one of the researchers who worked on the study was asked by journalist Gary Taubes, who's done fantastic work in this field, why didn't you ever publish it? And he said, there was nothing wrong with the study, but quote, we were just so disappointed in the results. Now, this was diabolical because this completely, in the only real study that determined, that tested in a causal way the heart health hypothesis, it showed that it not only wasn't true, but it was unhealthy. Imagine if this would have come out before the 1992 food pyramid came out, which told us to eat 8 to 11 helpings of grains. So this is why I want to tell your audience that this was intentional. This wasn't an accident. They knew the information. They knew we'd be sick. And if you go to Walmart in any place in America and look in line, you'll see the sickness of the American people. And it's only partially their fault because they've been given the wrong information. They've been psyoped. They've been gaslit.
Yeah. And it's the ramifications of this are massive. And I'm thinking, like, when you're talking about cereal earlier, like, I was born in 91. I'm a 90s kid. And I think we got the brunt of this cereal psyop, which is like, I remember growing up, Fruity Pebbles, Fruit Loops, Crispy, the Cookie Crisp.
A fucking cereal called Cookie Crisp.
Yeah, Cookie Crisp.
Cookie Crisp. It was awesome.
Chocolate, Puffs, whatever, Reese's Puffs, Cinnamon Toast Crunch. Like,
I was a Cinnamon Toast Crunch guy.
We were inundated with all the cereal propaganda on Nickelodeon in the 90s. Yeah. That's what we were like, mom, dad, we need all these cereals. And that
they were cheap. They're like, all right. And it says healthy. They're healthy for us.
Yeah. And it's so funny looking back. It was like the 90s. It was like cereal for breakfast. Candy was Fun Dip, where you literally take a stick, lick it, and dip it in sugar and put it in your mouth.
And with our skim milk, because, you know, we wanted our cooked skim milk. Yeah, dude, it was really insane. We took, because in 1980, the first food guidelines came out and they were relatively modest. They were insidious because they were eat less meat. It was always eat less meat, eat more grains, but it didn't give exact portions, to its credit. 1992 changed that. The food pyramid changed that. And you remember, like I did, I grew up in the 90s, where every pizza place and sub shop had the picture of it because it was like an advertisement for them. I ate so much of that shit, I can't even tell you. And I ate so much of it. And then when I turned 16, I got cancer.
Oh shit.
Yeah. I remember laying in my hospital bed asking my doctor, I'm like, well, how did I do this? Like, what happened? And I remember him saying, oh, it's nothing you did. It's genetics or something. We don't really know how cancer is caused. Well, I intuitively knew I had done something wrong to my body. I consumed a lot of seed oils and sugar and really terrible foods. So when I look back, I think what's more surprising is that I wasn't sicker, or that so many other kids were able to maybe have a little genetic privilege, as I would call it, and be able to sustain a diet like that. But I find, I guess what I really want to emphasize is that this was intentional. Like, they knew the information was out there and they did it anyways to people.
What do you think it was, more to control or to hide the inflation?
To hide it, because they can't control it. Because inflation exists in red meat, right? So when the USDA put out these guidelines, and I get that some people in your audience might be like, oh, it's the government. Who gives a shit what the government says about food? Well, keep in mind, when the USDA pushes out these guidelines, it becomes the law of the land in every public school in the country, every prison system, every hospital, every nursing home. So I go to school from, you know, first grade to, I dropped out of high school, so I, you know, I got through my junior year, but I was on a diet that by the time I came out of it, I was metabolically compromised by the state.
Yeah.
And I sometimes think about, I do these thought experiments where I try to think about what you think about, like the Wright brothers, and how much bravery it intellectually must have taken to even try to do what they did, or Edison. Would they have done these gifts with a public school diet of Cinnamon Toast Crunch bars? Would they have had the mental gumption and independence to do these things? And then it makes me think about all the gifts we're losing now when you look at these fat, flabby kids who can't run down a soccer field.
Well, it's, and the problem gets worse the further you fall down the economic ladder. So this is something I saw up close and personal in Chicago when I was living there. I volunteered and helped run an inner city lacrosse program where we go to the west side and south side of Chicago to have the kids get off the streets and play a sport. And what we focused on was lacrosse. And that was the jarring thing to me, is like these schools that we would go to, they were in food deserts. And so the guy who ran the program, Sam Angelotta, he would basically tell me like the day of the life of these kids, which is you're in a broken home, typically living with your aunt and your mother and your grandmother. And then you go to school and breakfast, it's not made at home. You stop at the gas station, you get a honey bun. Then you go into school. Then you have a multitude of factors creating a terrible environment for children to learn, let alone to succeed. And it's the food and the broken home life that really just creates this environment where it's literally impossible for most of these kids to ever have success long in life. And the food aspect of it too, think about how much it fucks up your mind if you're starting your day every day with a honey bun and a dollar sugar drink from the gas station. You're just hyperactive.
Do you feel it personally when you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
The
I think when I was younger I could stomach it more. Yeah. You know, because you have so much energy. Mm-hmm. But as I got older, I noticed I couldn't write as well. If I eat like a piece of shit, I can't. If I eat carbs, I can't. Even little things like when I'm transferring notes, I can't remember as much from one side to bring to my computer. It's like goes from one sentence. Now I can remember 3.5. It's like my mind's getting younger and more flexible the longer I persist on getting the nutrients I need.
Yeah, that was the one thing. One of the biggest dietary changes I ever made in my life was in my early 20s. I think it was 20 or 21. Like, again, I was psyoped into thinking that Gatorade was a healthy drink.
Oh, my God, me too, yeah.
That, like, hydrated you. And, like,
I mean, Michael Jordan drank it. Yeah. He was awesome.
Yeah, and so that was, like, throughout college, that's, like, I would drink Gatorade. And that was, like, my drink of choice. I'd be like, I don't need water. I need the electrolytes of Gatorade. And I don't know what it was particularly, but at some point I was like, I don't think this is good for me. I think just looking at the sugar, I was like, this is too much sugar. So I got Gatorade and sugary drinks and went to a liquid diet of water, coffee, and alcohol from time to time. But like cutting Gatorade out, like I had severe eczema my whole life and it went away. And I haven't had it in over a decade.
Oh, that's great.
I'm pretty sure it's because I cut out the sugary drinks.
The incestuousness of government food is the government food control of the food supply. Nina Teicholz has done great work in this field. She wrote a book called The Big Fat Surprise. I'd recommend everybody reads it. It really exposes a lot of the corruption and the science behind this. And she discovered that 95% of the people on the USDA Food Guidelines Committee are industry hacks. And they're the ones coming up with this data, and it's not real science. It's marketing, and I can't emphasize that enough. It's, you don't need these idiots to tell you what to eat. I mean, I sometimes think about these people who spend their life as nutritionists and spend years researching it and conclude that Fruit Loops are better than me. I can't, like, your life is a failure. Your whole life is a failure if you spend years on that and come out with that conclusion. And I want these people to look in the mirror. Like Dr. Cody Fatima Stanford, who's very articulate in her white coat, appearing on 60 Minutes, saying that obesity has nothing to do with lifestyle. You're a hack.
Yeah.
You're a hack, and you're vile because you're damaging people. Because what you're doing is you're separating people from, I think, one of the most fundamental parts of existence, which is control over our own health. You want us to outsource control over our health to you and the pharmaceutical companies. No.
No, and it's laughable. Like, now sitting here thinking about Fruit Loops. Fruit Loops is like the perfect example because it's literal, like, cardboard chip with sugar in it.
And it's delicious too.
It is. Well, that's the other thing. They literally,
like, you talking about it, actually, that's the thing. It's an addictive substance. I'm like, man, I really could go for a bowl of Fruit Loops right now.
Why is it an addictive substance? They literally manufacture the addictive nature of it.
Right? Hyperpalatable, yeah.
Yeah, they have these scientists that, that's the other thing. You talk about the corruption of fiat incentives to go, like, why don't we have the Wright brothers these days? Like, why are there so few, like, actual innovators in the physical world? Like, why aren't we building great things? Why is all the architecture shit?
Had an argument with my daughter about this last night. She's like, things are better fast. I'm like, no. Fastest airplane was, think in the 70s.
Yeah.
Like, our new things now are really just plus ones. We're adding on to existing technologies.
And it's breaking down. I mean,
yeah.
And so the point I'm trying to, like, the fiat has corrupted everything. We're like, the people who are really smart and could do great things, like, the incentives are such where the high paying jobs are, you're either quantum Wall Street or on the science side, you're figuring out ways to make people more addicted to food.
Friend of the fiat money printer, foe of the money fiat printer. John Yudkin experienced foe of the money printer. He was a great scientist who did lots of amazing research linking sugar to heart disease, not meat, yet he kind of died in relative, you know, not well known. Ansel Keys is a hero, friend of the money printer, died wealthy.
Yeah.
This is the world we live in today, and that's why Bitcoin's important. Every time you buy a little bit of Bitcoin, you take a shot at the money printer, and you make it a little more difficult, and you make the illusion that they perpetuate the distortions that they continue. You make them a little more strung out.
Yeah. And another great example, I wrote about it last week, is Boeing. Speaking of airplanes and the fact that we haven't like surpassed the benchmark set in the 70s in terms of speed and safety, like, with all the Boeing Air Maxes that are going down, having the doors ripped out of and the engines break mid-flight, having the wheels fall off, people are like, all right, what the hell went on? Well, they brought in a McKinsey consultant as their CEO in 2005, and he ran the company for 10 years. And when he came in, he told all the engineers, like, hey, we've reached the pinnacle of where we're going to get to in terms of engineering new airplanes and engines. We're not going to focus on engineering anymore. Like, we're focused on stock price. So if you look at, I believe it was 2003 to 2018, they spent 80% of their profits embarking in stock buybacks to juice their stock price. And if you look at their stock price over that time, it outperformed the S&P by many multiples. And so, again, fiat incentives corrupting a company that's been around for over a century, Boeing, and they, over the last 20 years, completely neglected their core competency, which is building reliable, safe, and innovative airplanes, delivering the market, and they focused on the fiat game, which is like, hey, we just need to increase shareholder value by driving our stock prices up. So instead of reinvesting profits and actually designing and bringing good jets to market. They just bought back stock to take to lower the denominator of their share float so that the price would go up and they get rewarded.
Even though you're saying this and your podcast is very well listened to and other people know this, it's still going to work out to their advantage. I'm convinced. It's they're going to keep, the people at the top are going to keep making a lot of money. Dr. Fatima Stanford, despite being of being an intellectual, you know, halfwit, got appointed to the USDA Food Guidelines Board. So, I mean, she got a promotion for her stupidity and saying that on 60 Minutes. And it's becoming more. I had my wife's a Montessori school teacher. Oh, she's going to love me saying this. Some kid was eating a whole bunch of sugar in class. And somebody was like, you got to be careful. You don't want to get diabetes. And another person in the school interrupted him. Was like, actually, no, sugar does no. They found out sugar does not cause diabetes anymore. It's part of the PSYOP. I mean, of course, sugar. It's glucose. I mean, they used to test diabetes back in ancient Greece by how bees were attracted to your urine. I want interesting visual to put into everybody's mind, but of course it's sugar. We all know it's sugar, but no, it's meat. It's meat. Everything is meat now because the temperature is meat. Population, it's all, everything will be blamed on meat, and we should eat like 16th century peasants. We should eat our grains.
Yeah. It's, well, not only the grains, now they want us to eat the bugs too.
Yeah, that's coming. But I feel like it's been kind of publicized enough where there's enough pushback. It seems like they've slowed down. They were pushing it, but they've slowed it down a little bit. So I'm hoping that we keep mentioning the bugs, because every time we do, I think they don't want to move too quickly, too fast, because what this is a slow boil. If they would have proposed these kinds of things in 1972, we would have rejected them out of hand. But, you know, they keep us boiling. They kept raising the temperature up on us slowly. We don't notice how quickly things have actually changed.
And it's really, again, nefarious and fucked up when you think about it. Because, like, is the sanctity of perpetuating the fiat monetary system worth all the collateral damage?
Yes, it's the most powerful weapon that these individuals will ever have, that the world has ever seen, weaponizing the entire productive labor of everybody to, like, they just need to hold on to it. They just need to hold on to it. And that's why I love that you have this podcast, because every time you talk, I mean, every podcast I've listened to for a while, you really expose the intellectual roots. You start pulling this shit out. And every, like, one person at a time, right? That's all it takes.
Yeah. Well, it's fitting that we're sitting here having this conversation. I'm very happy, number one, that it's with you. Number two, that it's in person, because this is TFTC episode 500.
Damn. I was telling your assistant, I'm like, balloons, do we get maybe some, like, cheese puffs come from the sky? How does cheese it work puffs. Here?
That was another one. We were addicted. They were Jack's. Jack's was the brand of cheese puffs that we liked growing up.
I had Utz, because I grew up in Pennsylvania. So I don't know if you know Bloomsburg.
Yeah.
My dad was a professor at Bloomsburg University, and that's what we were in Chicago originally, kind of like parallel a bit. And then my dad got a job at the university, so we moved to Pennsylvania. Yeah, the Utz was a big deal there.
The Utz family has a very famous house on the coast of Jersey and Avalon. It's hidden in the dunes, and you can go see. If you slow down your car, you can see they have like golden pretzels as the.
Oh, that's cool! I had French fries for the first time in 3 years last night because they were fried in lard and tallow, and at a restaurant here. I'm going to say it wrong.
Dewey.
That was, yeah.
Yeah.
Really it was hard good. To get in, and it was like expensive, but it was worth it.
That's one thing that gives me hope is that people are waking up. And even like my wife is a total seed oil Nazi now. Like she's nice. Reading every package, their ingredients, looking for seed oils, not buying it if seed oils are included. We buy beef in bulk, and it comes with tallow. So we'll cook things in tallow. But other things like Ziki is another food truck chain, I guess you can say, here in Austin, that they do everything in beef tallow.
Zeke, it's called?
Yes.
Okay.
Z-E-K-E? Z-I-K-I.
Okay.
I was a pub key in New York for the halving on Friday.
Oh, nice. How was that?
It was great. Incredible event. And
so there's a big community in New York as well?
Yes.
Okay.
There's an outpost that you can find
of heretics. Respite. You can heretics find and misfits.
Yes. And they moved all their frying to beef tallow.
Nice.
It actually just went live last week, so
it's weird because we're going back in time, because in 1990, McDonald's and Burger King fried their fries in beef tallow, mm-hmm. until the corporate funded studies came out telling you, oh my gosh, no, you can't do that. We need corn, soy, all these seed oils. And they flooded the market with corn through subsidies. And this is what we get. You go to Mexico, it's sugar in their Coke, because the subsidies for sugar are not like they are here. It's different.
It's one of my favorite long-lost clips is of Julia Child holding up a McDonald's french fry right after they transitioned away from beef tallow into seed oil. She's like, I'll never eat a McDonald's fry again. Like, they moved off of beef tallow. And so, like, Julia Child being included on that back then was interesting to know. There were people who were in the know were like, no, this is a bad idea. And yet, it was still forced on the market.
I really believe that we can't... It's hard to see... I got a great blurb from Tucker Carlson, who's a real inspiration to me, on my book. And he was talking about in the blurb how the American diet has made it difficult to think clearly.
Yeah.
And as a result, you can't really understand what they've done to the American. And I think about that a lot. It's like it really has compromised us quite a bit, where if you're in the fog, you stay in the fog. But if I can implore your audience to just try it for a few days, just try getting off the sugar addiction and the carb addiction, and just try eating some meat, and you'll find that it's worth it. And I know it's expensive to get a ribeye, but it's more expensive to be laid up in a hospital.
Yeah.
And to deal with a lot of those issues and get your insulin shots and have the lower time preference thinking, as Safe would say.
It's crazy how fast it can work too. I think my eczema used to be the bane of my existence. Like, I would get, really self-conscious about it, because it would flare up and be all over my arms.
You think it was from the dye in the Gatorade or the sugar? You don't know.
I think it was the sugar.
It was like 40 ingredients, so it's hard to pick out one, right?
But it was like, at the same time, I like cut out carbs as much as possible too, and it went away within a couple of weeks, and it has been back for a decade. Like, that nice. Is, I think it's a testament to the human body. Like, we can fill it with a bunch of this shit for a while.
But you should feel blessed that you had that happen to you too, in a sense. I know that sounds awful to say, but just because it was a tell, like, your body's a tell, and you were doing something wrong, and it shifted you to modify your behavior. It's like, if you put your hand on a stove, you don't want to remove the sensation of burning. You want to make sure you feel that, so you move your fucking hand.
Yeah.
Right? You moved your hand, and now look at you. You feel much better.
Yeah.
Great. It is.
And it's something, I have two young kids too, and that's something like...
How old are your kids?
4 and almost 2.
Oh, man, I have a 20-year-old, a 17-year-old, a 9-year-old, and a 12-year-old.
Oh.
All girls.
All girls.
I brought one of them with me to Austin, and she got orange-pilled at the event.
Did you find that you couldn't do the orange-pilling? That's what I found. People close to my life, whenever I try to orange-pill them, they're like, shut up. But then somebody else tells them, like, I think you were right.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like that. I did make her listen to the audiobook version of Fiat Food on the way up here, and she was very good about that. She pretended to listen and had interesting questions. Her generation is, she was explaining to me, she thinks they're ready for this sort of message because they're becoming skeptical. These are children of COVID now. Mm-hmm. Like, they have a history that you and I can't really understand. Like, the years of their childhood taken away from them. So I think they're beginning to be like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
At first they were scared. Now they're like, a lot of them are like, what the fuck was that? And they're angry.
As they should be.
Yeah.
No, I think, we see when our oldest, my oldest was born in February of 2020. We're lucky. We were in New York. We were one of the last families that were actually able to be there in the delivery room. We had our parents in the waiting room. I think a week later was when they were like, nobody can be in the hospital.
Wow.
We have to be masked up. For my oldest son, like for the first 2 years of his life, everybody was wearing a mask and he has a speech delay. And we're pretty confident that it was because of that. Like he literally in those formative years wasn't seeing people move their lips and articulate. And so he had no reference point from which to develop his own speech.
Is it coming?
Yeah, it's coming back. He's much better. But when he was like two and starting to talk,
it's like, what a weird social experiment, because how many social cues people get from your face, especially children, they're trying to grow up and understand and learn. And luckily we were already in Patagonia, Arizona at that time. I've never put a mask on. I refused. Mm-hmm. Part of it was like, I'm a dad. I don't want my kids to see me mask. Like, what does that say about their dad? And, but I was also fortunate. I'm a writer. Like, would I have been so brave if I had to go to a job where my family's livelihood depended on me? I like to think I would have been, but I don't know. That's difficult.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the reason we came down here. We were lucky we escaped to the confines of South Jersey and Cape May County. We thought we were going to be there for 2 weeks. We were there for 18 months, but where we were, it's a sleepy beach town in the off season.
I know Cape May.
Yeah. And most people did not.
Living in Brooklyn, Cape May was the vacation spot.
Yeah. Like we didn't wear masks everywhere. But still we were on this island and everybody was mainly isolated. So we didn't see many people for the first 18 months of my son's life. Obviously towards summer 2021, I think everybody was like, all right, we're going to go to the beach. We'll be fine. But, simple interactions with people wearing masks throughout that, even if it wasn't every day, I think it was enough to,
you know, they've conditioned us though to, when I wrote this book, it occurred to me how longstanding the attempt to get to the point where they could mandate masks and we would accept it. Because really, you know, with fiat currency, when Nixon decoupled, they essentially took away our ability to control what we earn, because unless you own the fiat money printer, you don't control your productivity. Saying you own your money is a slogan. It's a fucking slogan. It's not true. Like, you don't, because somebody else can make as much of it as they want. My Bitcoin I own. Yeah. Nobody, I have my keys. Nobody can make more of my Bitcoin. But then with food, by telling us what we could eat and couldn't eat, they really extended their ability for control. And I really feel like the vaccine was the next step logically. Like, now it's, we don't have control over our productive labor. We don't have control over our health. Like, we have to outsource that. So we become dependent on real experts who are going to tell us how to eat, what value our money will have, and what drugs we need to be injected with by which pharmaceutical companies, how often and when. That's where we are.
Yeah.
And it's 2024.
And you think about the clown, like, it is so insane. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. And then you're like, how does nobody else see this? But like, just the the ploys that were used, particularly around the vaccine, that compound a lot of what we're talking about right now. Like, if you had what was the mayor before Adams?
I knew de Blasio.
De Blasio, yeah. De Blasio being like, if you go get your vaccine, we'll give you free Shake Shack. So like, go get the experimental vaccine, and then we'll reward you with some seed oil soaked fried food.
It's because they fucking hate you. I mean, it's the only explanation I could come up with. They fucking hate us.
Eating the fries like a slob in the press conference. And it's like literally looking at
us. Working,
like,
in New York too, he was public advocate when I was there. And I can tell you personally, he's a complete piece of shit. He would show up late to everything. He just, no respect, that he was slovenly. He didn't take care of himself. And I could not believe he got elected mayor. I mean, it's almost comical to me. It was like the least exceptional human beings get appointed to these positions of power because they have this special skill of acquiring power somehow, and it's amazing to me.
Well, you brought up Tucker. I mean, he was on Rogan over the weekend.
I didn't get to hear that.
Well, that's what, I didn't watch the whole thing yet, but I did see this one clip that actually Parker sent to me last night, in which they were talking about Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and the fact that he was marketed on the right as somebody would get in there and he'd like fight for the rights. He'd fight for the conservative movement and really push things along to fight back against the left. that's how he was marketed. He's got in, and obviously they just signed this bill sending more money to Ukraine, and it seems everybody's like, what the fuck? He was marketed as this guy who was going to fix things, and he hasn't done anything. In fact, he's gone the complete opposite direction. He's buddied up with the left, and Tucker made this point. It's like, yes, it's what people in power want, is weak men in positions of influence. And so Mike Johnson is an example of a weak man that could be manipulated by interests behind him who have the actual power. And same thing with de Blasio, like a weak man. So like, to answer the question, it's like, how do these people get in? It's like, they're identified as weak men who have a very loose moral compass, who will blow with the wind when it is advantageous to them. And that's who's puts in these positions of power. And so whether it's de Blasio or Mike Johnson, that's how we end up with these caricatures of people who are supposed to be fighting for American citizens at the end of the day.
That makes a lot of sense, and I'd love to read that book at some point. I mean, I find Tucker Carlson remarkably insightful, and just like yourself, like, he's going to be moving into different... He's I'm so happy he's freed himself from Fox News, because I think the long form format fits him so much better. Mm-hmm. Because he's very, very thoughtful, and it's just difficult. I've been on his show when he had his Fox News show, and you know, you have a little bit of time, and but he's not that guy. He never was that guy. He was always long. He should have always been. This is much more natural, and he'll be much more effective. Fox News should have never fucking fired that guy, because now he's off the chain.
Yeah.
And now he can talk to us directly.
And he's probably going to make more money in the long run, too. Which I think that's, yeah. I mean, and you've seen it, whether it's Tucker, Megyn Kelly, on the other side, Don Lemon, Chris Cuomo. You're seeing all these people who came up in legacy media begin to defect and be like, no, I can do this independently. And
yeah, I find that whole thing fascinating too. I wrote a book called about Matt Drudge. I don't know if you know who that is. Mm-hmm. And just how he changed media. And I have a movie coming out to that effect. I wrote the screenplay for it. It's my first venture into screenwriting. I'm excited about that. But the whole switch of media has always long fascinated me. And it really began, I remember, when Matt came out with his website in the early 90s, because ahead of then, there was a monopoly of four networks that if they, and a few magazines and a newspaper, that if they were gatekeepers of information. So they would tell us what we needed to know, but they would, you know, what they thought we needed to know. Matt Drudge broke that, but then, I know we're going off subject a little bit, but then media got consolidated again. Like, the internet was the promise of freedom, the populist movement of information, and then it all got consolidated again by Google, Apple, these tech companies. It's very interesting, but now you're seeing it break apart again with you and Tucker and Rogan and these characters who get wide audiences by really just putting on heretical ideas, letting people discuss them. It's amazing, man. Well, congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I mean,
500 episodes is something to be proud of. That's a lot.
And I stumbled into this. I didn't even want. I studied economics and was just really into Bitcoin. And,
who's going to want to hear somebody talk about economics for a fucking hour and a half a day? That's ridiculous.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Rogan's always said this, and part of the reason why the format of the show is the way it is like the long form discussion just enables so much more exploration of topics that deserve more than 90-second. Speed hits.
I was telling people last night in Austin about this, about how back then you could fake it. You didn't even really have to know your information. You could, it was so short. You could do like 2.5 minutes and just have a few slogans you say. I mean, that was more effective anyways, because you needed sound bites, right? You can't fake it anymore.
No.
Like you're gonna have somebody on for an hour and a half. They better fucking know what they're talking about, or they'll be exposed and it'd be very obvious. And I love that about the new format.
Yeah. And then the other end, there's interviewing. Like, you better know what questions asked, and you can't just be like a pretty face in front of a camera.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Not saying that,
but you are a pretty face, Marty. I'm just gonna throw that out there.
Oh, thank you, Matthew. Yeah. No, it is. It's exciting. It's also exhilarating. It feels like we're in this crazy inflection point where, especially post COVID, many people are waking up, and at the same time, the incumbent fiat system is doubling, tripling down as they lose control. And so that's the big question in my mind over the next 5 years, particularly, is how does this narrative battle evolve and who wins out ultimately? Because there's a lot at stake.
My take on it is that people are generally misled by believing that this is a battle between the left and the right. I would posit that this is a battle for self-autonomy by individuals who are done with being told how to live, how to breathe, what to inject themselves with, which flavored Cheetos to eat. It's a battle of ideas, and it's a battle over control of not any specific group of people, but individuals across the country wanting to retain control of themselves again and to own their own lives.
Yeah. And that's a very important thing to highlight. And I've mentioned this many times in the last few episodes, but Michael Goldstein's Big Block Boom 2019 presentation on rhetoric and meme warfare has had a profound impression on my life. Now I view a lot of what's going on in the world.
Where do I find that? Is it on YouTube?
It's on YouTube. Yeah. Search it.
Michael Goldstein.
BitBlockBoom 2019.
BitBlockBoom. Okay. I'm going to.
The Art of Bitcoin Rhetoric. Obviously focused on like the rhetoric Bitcoiners should be using to get across messages effectively. But really approaches it from first principles perspective on rhetoric generally. And one thing that the media and the incumbent power structure does very well is use the rhetorical trick of framing things a certain way where they box you into a frame, and left versus right is the predominant frame that everybody is caught onto, hook, line, and sinker. And you're just put in this box, this rhetorical box, where you're told this is where the discourse happens. This is the battle lines that exist in which you have to strategically move within, and it's just not true. Like, that just, I think in it, he's like, do not let them put you in their frame. You have to own the frame. So to that point, it's like switching the frame. It's not left versus right. It's individual versus power structure that wants to take away your autonomy.
Exactly. I think that's exactly, you hit it. That's the core of it. It's individuals who want to take away our autonomy. It's not about me agreeing with you, Marty. It's about you agreeing that I have the right to do it. What the fuck I want, as long as I'm not hurting anybody. I wish my inner philosophies were more complicated, but it really boils down to that. Just leave me alone unless I'm not hurting anybody.
Well, that's almost the paradox of it all. It is actually more, it's like when you get back to first principles, it's like very simple. Yeah. Just let people do what they want to do as long as they're not hurting anybody else, and they're in interacting in consensual agreements with other individuals. They should be fine to do that. And
what they've done to the food supply, what they've done by concealing the information, by manipulating the science, by weaponizing the fiat money printer, all in the name of distorting the effects and consequences of monetary inflation, I would argue is the most consequential crime of the century, because what it does is it makes us dependent by compromising our health metabolically. It's not like 4% of the population has diabetes. It's like 60. We're approaching half of pre-diabetes. I mean, it's in our younger kids. They're growing up. Most of them now, by the time of 14, most of them, a significant number, are already going to be dependent. They don't have their self-autonomy. They're going to be dependent on the medical system. They're going to become part of it. And there's no good ending. There's no good ending to that. Yeah. It's sad.
The LTV of Generation Alpha and Gen Z for the pharmaceutical industry is probably, the long-term value as a customer of that industry is probably multiples of what it was in the 70s.
You go through the paper. I went through like some of the papers I got access to about with pharma, and you know, the argument that kept coming up was how these weight loss shots, which we were talking about earlier, are going to replace statins as the most profitable drug in the history of the world, because you get a kid on it at 11. It's a lifelong drug. You can't go off of it. You get the shot. Well, until the effects become too evident, then they'll switch it.
Well, the effects are like crazy. People are literally dying by choking on their own shit because it paralyzes your stomach and you can't.
I mean, nature matters, right? Like, nature and health, there's a synchronicity, and there's no shot that's going to make you skinny. Don't staple your stomach. That's fucking weird. Right? Like, stop it. Just stop eating shit. Yeah. Like, stop eating. It's amazing what happens when you just stop eating shit. It's like, I wish I could give a more complicated dietary advice to anybody, but just stop eating toxins.
Yeah.
Like, go back to the food. If they ate it 100 years ago, you're good.
Yeah.
You know? But right now, our, like, the amount of sugar we're consuming right now is over 150 pounds a year. In the 1700s, the average person ate 4 pounds. Huh. And I had somebody explain to me, well, you know, people evolve. No, you don't evolve like that. Evolution doesn't work that quickly. We've been here a long time. 300 years is a tiny drop in the water. We have not evolved, which is why we're metabolically compromised.
Yeah. No, it is crazy when you look at, like, B-roll footage from the 70s of
the line of people at Star Wars opening, yeah. Right? They're all skinny. They all have clear complexions.
And that's like one of the go-to B-roll footages of, like, CNN and MSNBC is, like, the bottom half of fat people walking while they're talking about, like, a diabetes epidemic.
Yeah.
It is alarming. Just looking out, like, at how many people and just how fat they are. You talked about kings of medieval time, it was a sign of wealth. Like, they weren't even that fat.
No.
And you go back to, like, the 90s, the movies in the 90s or the sitcoms, and the caricature of a fat person
looks
pretty healthy.
So you're Chicago, right? I'm
from Philly originally. I went to college in Chicago.
I'm obsessed with the 1985 Chicago Bears. It was the last team that I was 7 at the time. And William the Refrigerator Perry was a parody for his size. He would be undersized today as a defensive lineman. He weighed a little over 300 pounds. Right now, he wouldn't be able to make it in the league. He'd be too small.
Yeah. It's insane.
Yeah.
Do you think, what's the reception to the book been like so far? Have you?
Okay, so shockingly good. I mean, I've been pretty astounded by, I wrote this as a passion project. I didn't expect to make any money on this book. I just felt it was important. I have 4 daughters. I wanted them to read it. You know, I never self-published, so I went with Safe's publishing house, and I know that he has a big following, but it's a weird niche topic, fiat food, like, what? And I also knew that I wouldn't be able to get the publicity I traditionally get from my more, you know, when I used to not be a heretical journalist, when I used to be considered a mainstream journalist. But it's being currently translated into different languages in Poland and Norway, and I couldn't have been more surprised. It's one of these books that, you know, have you published before, Marty? I'm sorry.
I have not. Something I need to...
Traditionally, what happens is the book comes out and there's a huge, like, wave of sales, and then it dies. This has been growing the opposite, where it seems to be picking up momentum, which it's just really gratifying. I'm very, very, very appreciative. I'm appreciative for you having me on and letting me share this story.
No, well, it's an important story. And I think that trend that you're seeing is a testament to something we've been touching on, which is, like, people are starving for this information, pun intended. Because I think intuitively, whether people verbalize it or recognize it explicitly, they know something's off.
On social media now, like, once every 2 days, maybe I'll get a message from somebody who's just like, this changed my life. And it's really gratifying to me to hear this, because I also just have to bring it back to Safe, because his chapter saved, like, changed my life, his chapter in Fiat Standard on fiat food. And to be able to do an in-depth investigation and really spell it out, I have over 200 citations. I bring all the receipts on this one. The argument, I know it sounds really far out there. That's why I meticulously go over every detail, and I try to tell it in a narrative, fast moving approach, but I mean, I couldn't be more proud of this book. It's actually, of all the things I've written, and I've written movies, I've had my life portrayed in a TV show. I've done a lot of cool shit, you know? I've written a lot of books, hundreds of magazine and newspaper articles. I've done nothing in my life aside from having my children and my family that I'm more proud of than this work.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you have hope that we'll get back to, I mean, we'll consider this good journalism. It seems like journalism is dying to a certain extent.
You got somebody like Tucker. You got you. This is journalism. Yeah. Glenn Greenwald. There's still some really great journalists out there.
Yeah.
And I'm hopeful that journalism's going to be saved, but it's a lot of shit. It's a lot of, turn off the TV.
A lot of native ads, right?
Yeah.
It's really not journalism in a lot of cases. It's advertising.
PR, yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever listened to the No Agenda podcast?
Yeah, I have. Look, I was born in 77, so Adam Curry is sort of a legend to me.
That's the one thing I love that they do is just take a news segment and just completely dismantle it and point out like how this is a native ad, like somebody paid for this.
Yeah.
Like they're literally paying to get stories that people take are like, oh, this is science. It's like, no, that was paid for.
It's paid for. There was a study. I was showing my daughter a study recently, and it was about candy being healthy for you. And it was a CBS News story that was reporting on the story. And the lead was, and I might get this slightly wrong, but the lead was, guess what's worse for your child's weight than eating candy? Hyphen, not eating candy. A new study, a shocking new study. And the study was sponsored by the confectionery organizations. And it's not a study. It's not science. Like, you can't do that. But you're inundated with these things. So people get a pass on being confused about what to eat. But you don't even really need to buy my book. I hope you do. You understand it all. But just check on not your grandmother, but what your great-great-grandmother was eating.
Yeah.
Because you're living off of her genetics, by the way. Your great-great-grandkids' genetics might not be as strong if you don't make a change and we don't clean things up.
I mean, not even have great-great-grandkids if you don't.
That's a scary thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
That would be Kellogg's dream, to bring it all back to John Harvey.
Right.
And to just...
a population bomb.
Just kill it all. Just end it all and end the sex drive, and then we'll all be pure and we'll all go to heaven in the same boat.
Yeah. Which is... insane. This is how these people think. It's I mean, you look at birth rates around the world, people are like, what's going on here? Maybe it's the food.
Yeah, I mean, we're eating more grains, we're not eating as much meat. I mean, that's definitely a huge part of it. It's fertility rates among men and women are shockingly small. And in Italy, I know they're paying people to try to have kids and are trying to bring it on, but
similarly, Hungary, I think if you have four kids, you don't pay any income tax.
Man, I should move there. I have four kids.
Yeah.
Do well there. I pay a lot in taxes.
And it all feeds into each other. It's like, the food's fucking us from a fertility perspective. And then the money's fucking many people are delaying family formation because they don't think they can afford it. And then by the time they can afford it, particularly for women, they're in their mid-30s. And for a lot of them, it's too late to have... as many kids as they want to, and some of them to have any kids at all, which is just really fucked up to think about.
Buy Bitcoin, end the distortion, eat meat,
and buy fiat food. Is this on Amazon too, or just the Safe House?
Amazon too. Thank you.
Thesafehouse.com. Use the code TFTC. You'll get $5 off this.
Nice.
And then you can buy it on Amazon as well. Matthew, thank you so much for writing this. Thank you for joining us. I'm happy we can do this in person.
Really appreciate meeting you too.
This was a great 500th episode. TFTC 500. I'm very happy it was this one.
Thank you.
Peace and love, freaks.